High Medieval, 1,000 years of people behaving badly. Later on, some people will behave badly and forget to push their recording button, and then they'll have to push it again. Hi, I'm Anne Brannon. I'm your host who's recording, actually recording, in Albuquerque.
And I'm Michelle Butler in Maryland, the most medieval state in America.
And we are today talking about the Sicilian Vespers. The phrase refers to the whole 6-week period of the rebellion, but it's called the Sicilian Vespers. It starts at Vespers in Palermo in Sicily. Vespers is the evening service. It starts at sunset. It started on Easter Monday of 1282. Easter Monday is the Monday after Easter, for those of you who don't have church calendars in your heads. And it started outside the Church of the Holy Spirit, which was right outside Palermo. Then it was an incident which started the slaughter of Frenchmen in Sicily, ending up 4,000 to 8,000. I've seen actually numbers ranging like that.
It's a huge massacre, and I'd never heard of this before.
It was a huge massacre.
I swear that I am, in fact, a trained medievalist, but yeah. I had never heard of this. Well,
we are both trained medievalists, but we want to remind you all that the Middle Ages takes up 1,000 years. And since we're doing Latin Middle Ages, it's all of Europe. It's like, it's really big. It's so big. So no, not everything is in our heads. So we like to learn stuff. And so now we're doing Sicilian Vespers. And I have so much to explain about the Sicilian Vespers, because you might say to yourself, well, why did the Sicilians just kind of like all of a sudden slaughter all the Frenchmen? Why indeed?
So what the hell were there any Frenchmen doing in Sicily in the first place?
What were they doing? Yeah, why were there that many Frenchmen annoying the Sicilians? I am now going to explain. So Sicily is that large island that's off the lower tip of Italy. And the Greeks colonized it starting in about 734 BC. Then Carthage and Greece were at war a lot. Carthage gained control of most of the island by the 4th century BC. And then Rome had some wars with Carthage in the 3rd century BC. And there were successes, losses, back and forth. But Rome took control of Sicily in 146 BC. And at that point, it was Roman, and it remained Roman for a long time, like 600 years. So this was very kind of, I don't know, restful. And Latin's the language. All right. But then, you know, there's that point where the Middle Ages start, which is when the Roman Empire kind of like falls all apart, which the Gauls were helping with. So the Gauls helped the Roman Empire fall apart, and the Vandals took Sicily in 440 AD. And then the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, took Sicily in 535. And then the Ostrogoths took Sicily back for the Gauls in 550. And then the Byzantines took it back in 552. And at that point, it became an important Byzantine outpost. Greek supplanted Latin. The Eastern church rites were used. And so there's another little rest.
When this change in governance is happening, is that just a change at the top? Or are there population shifts happening every time there's a conquest?
There's some intermarriage, and the language gets affected. So there's like constant changes at the level of the populace, not as much, no, as at the level of governance. But there is there's this series of different, not just governments, but different cultures taking over Sicily. And the Sicilians are being themselves. I'm impressed with them myself. Okay, so at this point, where are we? The Byzantines take it in 552, and so yay, fine. But then in 826, the Byzantine fleet commander got into some kind of trouble. He married somebody and got that he wasn't supposed to, none, I think. He got in trouble. So he rebelled, and he ended up in exile in North Africa. So he got Ziyadat Allah, the Tunisian emir, to help him out. So an Islamic army invaded Sicily, and it took a while, but the Emirate of Sicily was in place by 902. Things weren't peaceful, though, because there was infighting amongst the Arabs, and there were revolts from the Byzantine/Sicilians, so the structure wasn't really strong, which meant that when the Normans showed up, These are like the Vikings that went to France and learned how to eat nice food and talk a kind of version of French, and then continued to be Vikings by invading various places. But then the Normans showed up, the island fell eventually to them. They were storming it. The fights were from 1060 to 1091. And of course, the Normans conquered England in 1066. And then some of the Anglo-Viking rebels went to fight against the Normans in Sicily, like around 1068. I love that part. I had not known this whatsoever.
Yeah, that's wild. They're conquering Sicily right after they've conquered England. I didn't know that either. Wow.
Yeah, I had no idea. I knew that they conquered Ireland about 100 years after they conquered England. I had no idea until fairly recently that they were messing around in Sicily.
Huh. I did not know that. They're pretending not to be barbarians, but really they are Vikings in a French trench coat.
Yeah,
nothing has changed.
I have trouble now because I think of the Normans as Vikings and I keep calling them Vikings, which I'm sort of really not supposed to, you know, but anyway.
It begs the question about naming, right? How is what they're up to different than what their predecessors were up to?
Well, they're speaking a version of French. That's really basically, I think it, well, you know, and they like, I don't know, everything gets connected.
The castles are the big difference.
It's castles. That's what it is. Because the Vikings weren't big on castles. No.
The Normans built big castles.
They liked castles. They did. Yeah. Oh, and you had asked me at one point, like, why are all these people invading Sicily? Sicily is volcanic and the land is really, really rich. And also the location, quite useful for getting to places around. So, yeah. So we all want Sicily. All right, where am I? The Normans. Okay, so the Normans held Sicily from, you know, they start with 1060 to 91. They established the Kingdom of Sicily like in 1130. And at that time, Sicily was one of the most wealthiest and powerful places in Europe. The Normans brought the Roman Church back, so much for the Byzantine Rite, and they brought their version of Latin, French Latin-y kind of thing. And things were great for a while. But in 1189, the ruler at the time, who was William the Good, was married to Richard the Lionheart's sister, Joanna. He died and he had no heir. Uh-oh!
That is never good.
It's not good in medieval Europe to die without an heir, because then what you have to get is pieces of history. So the crown, due to various marriages and, you know, births and deaths and whatnot, was supposed to go at that point to the Henry who was going to end up being the Holy Roman Emperor, Henry VI. It was supposed to go to him. But the Sicilian barons didn't like this. No, no. So they installed Tancred, who was a second cousin to William II, that person who just died. But Henry took Sicily in 1194 when Tancred died. Okay, so at this point, the Germans own Sicily. Really, at this point, we should just go lie down.
It was their turn.
Apparently. So this went on for a while. It's the Hohenstaufen reign. So during which the Muslims who were left in Sicily were repressed. They revolted and they got expelled. And so they're gone. So we're nearly there. We're nearly caught up. I swear. So the end of the Hohenstaufen dynasty was in 1266. The papacy had been an enemy of the Hohenstaufens because this was all part, and now we return to some of our earlier podcasts, this was all part of the Guelph and Ghibelline conflict, where the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire were at odds.
Yeah, our very first podcast was dipping into that.
That's right. You can go back to our very first podcast where we explain a great deal of that, because we found that totally interesting. Yeah, what is that? That's
it was Big Dog.
Big Dog, yeah.
Con Grande.
Con Grande de la Scala. That's who it is, yes, Con Grande. Yes, he got poisoned with foxglove, and so you can go learn all about that and why Dante was hanging out. At any rate, so this was all part of the Guelph-Ghibelline conflict, and so the papacy backed an invasion of Sicily, which was led by Charles I, the Duke of Anjou. He was one of the Capetians. And so then Sicily was conquered by the French. That's what the French were doing there. And so that started in 1266.
Okay. He's got to be related to our notorious villain, Philip IV, who keeps showing back up.
Well, he's Capetian, so yeah. Yeah.
I don't remember whether he's a brother or an uncle, but he's got to be related to him.
There's got to be some relation. They're all the Capetians. Oh, right. My God. Okay. So the French are there, and they didn't, I'm sorry to tell you, that they were not good at governing Sicily. Charles taxed the Sicilians really, really heavily. He was trying to pay for the Crusades and whatnot. The nobility had no share in the government, and also, apparently, they were sort of snooty. I don't know. They were bad. So that brings us to our crime. The French had annoyed the Sicilians very badly. At sundown on Easter Monday at the Church of the Holy Spirit, which was outside Palermo, a Frenchman insulted a Sicilian woman, and there was a riot, and 4,000 French people were killed within 6 weeks. Now, we have differing accounts as to exactly what happened. 2,000 people, by the way, were killed that first night. Just on that first night, 2,000 Frenchmen were killed. I think we're in agreement on. That was in Palermo. It goes on outside the city later, and then more people get slaughtered. So we have different versions. The Sicilians were gathered at the church. Fair enough. Okay, because you have to go to Vespers. It's Easter Monday. But Lent is over, and so they're celebrating. And Frenchmen came by, and either they started drinking with the Sicilians, or they came on over to the Sicilians to check for weapons, different versions. If they were checking for weapons, they started fondling the breast of the women, and so the Sicilians got angry. Or if they were drinking with the Sicilians, one of them dragged a young married woman out of the crowd, either to rape her or intended to rape her. And if that's what happened, either her husband stabbed the Frenchman or she did. Although it may be that none of this happened at all, and that the Sicilians organized and planned a revolt, whatever, this happened. Something happened at Vespers in Palermo in 1262 at Easter Monday, and a bunch of Sicilians killed
That's
a bunch of
Frenchmen. That's an awful lot of people to get killed in an unplanned uprising.
Yes, it is. And there's this business about the bells. The bells start ringing for Vespers. If indeed what's going on is everybody's there waiting for Vespers, the bells start ringing. But if what's going on is that this is organized, what happens is that the bells start ringing for Vespers, and that's the signal.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like, yeah, planning. There's a piece of this that sounds kind of made for movie, you know? So the idea that there's a plan that when the bells go, I mean, that sounds awesome.
Yes, it does, but it doesn't show up till later. It's not one of the earlier versions. Mm-hmm, yeah. But it does. But that's the thing. You and I both immediately, well, that's the version that makes sense. Let's have a revolt. You know, on the other hand, it's also true that if you have pushed people far enough, they will riot and revolt. Mm-hmm. And then it's very clear that there was organization really soon. Either there was organization that started this, or there was organization really soon. Mm-hmm. And so it may be that some very astute political minds took hold of the situation and moved it on out. But the business about, you know, the bells are our signal, that doesn't show up till later.
That's too bad, because that's pretty cool. But yeah, it's a little bit screenplay-y to make me think that it could be real.
Well, and the whole one of the Frenchmen insulted one of the Sicilian women. That's the first, when I first saw this, that's when I'm like, oh, really? Because that, you know, I'm really, because that's not enough. You know, I figured there was something physical involved. But that also, I don't know. All of it seems both probable and improbable.
Hmm.
But what we do know is that then a bunch of Frenchmen got slaughtered. The Sicilians attacked the Frenchmen with rocks and weapons, depending on what they were carrying, and all of the Frenchmen outside the church were killed. And when the bell started ringing, and whatever the connection is, the members of the group then ran through the city, calling on the men to rise up against the French. And that night, all the French people in Palermo, men, women, and children, and also like Sicilian women who had married Frenchmen, were slain in their homes, in the inn. They went into the inns that the French people were frequenting, and at the abbeys and convents, religious people who were dragged on out. And if they couldn't say chichiri, they were killed. Now, this means chickpea, but this is the sign, chichiri, that if you can say this right, like a Sicilian, then they didn't kill you. And apparently French people can't say this whatsoever. Now, I am not clear why this is, but I figure that I must be saying it wrong myself, and that were I to be in Sicily at this time, I would be killed that night, for I could not say that word. Because I think I'm saying it, but obviously I must not be. It's C-I-C-I-R-I, chichiri.
So does that piece strike you as real, or does that strike you as made up after the fact?
Both. It's not unusual to have a kind of way that you tell who is who. And the French people in the town, that's one thing. But people who are all wearing the same habit, how do you tell? You've got to have some kind of way of knowing who they are if you're intending only to slaughter some of them. So it seems reasonable. It also seems reasonable to me that it got added later because it's a lovely little detail. Chichiri. The revolt spread to other cities and all of the island was taken back except for Messina, which actually held out for another 6 weeks. But by the end of April, it also had revolted. So that was the end of the Vespers. I want to keep going though. And sort of explain what happened, because they're like, okay, and then the end of the Sicilian Vespers, all the Frenchmen are dead. All right. But here's what happened. The rebels asked the Pope to recognize them as a free state, answerable only to the Pope, but the Pope refused because he was in allegiance with Charles, and he ordered them to obey Charles, which they didn't want to do. So they went to Peter III of Aragon. His wife, Constance, was the daughter of the former king of Sicily. That's what the connection is. And she's the only heir of Frederick II, the Holy Roman Emperor, who was actually free at that time. Everybody else was captive in various places. So anyway, so they go to Peter. And Peter had already put an invasion fleet together before this all happened, telling the Pope that he was going to use it against the Islamic people in the north of Africa. So he was actually ready. So he was ready. Yeah. So he invades and he's acclaimed as the king, Peter I of Sicily, at Palermo that September. Charles tried, but he wasn't able to take the island back. At that point, Catalan and Aragonese were the languages of the court. The people spoke Sicilian. And Sicily remained Aragonese until 1479, when Aragon and Spain were combined. So then it was Spanish until 1738. And then it was Bourbon until 1860, when it was merged with Sardinia. And then that became the Kingdom of Italy in 1861. That's how long the Sicilians have been Italian.
Wow.
Not wow, indeed.
Very long.
No, in my mind, 1861 is like yesterday.
Yeah. I mean, that's contemporary with the American Civil War, so really wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't that long ago at all. Yeah, so the Sicilian Vespers, this is kind of like a piece of a long history of invasions of Sicily and different governments in Sicily, and the Sicilians getting annoyed here and there. But that was the most spectacular. Now, I need to quash a rumor, because the mafia started this rumor, and it is untrue. The Sicilian Vespers are not the beginning of the mafia. No. The mafia didn't exist at all until the 19th century. Italy wasn't able to rule Sicily effectively. It was on the edge of things. And so the mafia rises up and they they say they're connected to the Sicilian Vespers, and they use the term, but they're not. It's like, no. No, they weren't. But this rebellion, it survives in art. It's, if you go Google Sicilian Vespers and click on images, you can see this enormous amount of images, mostly from the 19th century, of, you know, the Sicilian Vespers and Sicilian slaughtering Frenchmen. It's really quite effective. And there's a couple of operas, there's plays, there's novels. And the phrase, because there's the Italian security forces fighting the mafia, used the phrase Sicilian Vespers operation. There's bands, you know. So the Sicilian Vespers, that's what that was. So with the crime, there might have been a crime to begin with, which was assaulting a woman outside the church, the Holy Church in Palermo. But then there was a crime, which was slaughtering all the Frenchmen in an act of really bloody rebellion. Very, very bloody indeed.
This sort of thing just doesn't usually work. We see all kinds of rebellions, but they're just not usually effective.
No. Like the peasants' revolt in England led to absolutely nothing in terms of rights for the peasants or anything. It just comes down in history as an idea, but it didn't get anything done whatsoever.
One thing I didn't know until the reading that I did for this was that this conflict in Sicily, where the Pope really strongly allies himself with the French, is the beginning of what results in the papacy spending time in Avignon. That he's so strongly allied with the French at that point that they end up in France for a while. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Oh, okay. All right. And that's an offshoot of the Guelph and Ghibelline conflict. Okay. So that's how we get to Avignon. All right. Thank you.
So this all was really interesting. It was stuff I didn't know any of this.
And how often do we say this?
I know. I really actually did go to school. But the thing is, when your focus is on England, all of the stuff that's happening in the Mediterranean is kind of peripheral.
Except when Chaucer goes to Italy, that's like an important piece of things, yeah. Boccaccio, yeah. Boccaccio meets Chaucer, yeah.
Englishmen every once in a while go to Italy and have adventures and come back and tell about them, but it's, you know, it's pretty far from England.
Well, yeah, unless William the Conqueror has invaded your country and you have to go to Sicily to, you know, fight the Normans because you lost in England. Yeah, but it's far. Well, yeah, no, so this was fairly new. I had known like tiny pieces of the history of Sicily. I had not known how vexed this was.
I really did not know how central to all of the quarrels that are going on Sicily was.
Yeah, it's connected to everything. Mm-hmm.
Just astonishing.
And the Sicilians got tired of it. I mean, as one would. I mean, because people come, they give the others, here's a new language and there's a new culture. And plus, we're changing the church and we want some money from you. And, you know, and what are we getting out of this? As Sicilians, really, basically, a bunch of bother is what. And so, if you're as badly behaved as the French were, they've had it up to here. They're done.
I wonder if that made any of the later conquerors be a little bit more judicious in their taxation.
Well, I don't know about the taxes, but I do know that things kind of calmed down. They're Aragonese for quite some time. And then they're Spanish. You know, it's like things get a little calmer.
So this is the part where I confess that my research went to hell and gone.
It's rabbit hole. It's Michelle goes down the rabbit hole time. We need a little theme for this because you are so rabbit hole oriented. You truly are.
I just went where the reading took me. And this time it didn't take me anywhere near what I was supposed to be learning about.
Well, I'm glad that I could tell you all about Sicily because
thank
you go.
God you knew. Because what happened was I started to try to track down what the actual sources were for this. And what I found was two things, okay? One is that there is a chronicle, an actual chronicle, from 1414.
So that's like 150 years later.
Yes, so how the hell is that a useful source? But the guy who wrote it is really interesting. His name is Leonardo Bruni. So I went down the rabbit hole of learning about Leonardo Bruni because he apparently is thought of as being the first modern historian. And he advances this division of history into the classical, the Middle Ages, and the Renaissance. And I thought that was just, because I kind of had that in my head as being a later thing.
Well, yeah, because Gibbon really makes that such a thing. Yeah,
but
well, Gibbon's the Dark Ages, but he dates the Middle Ages from the fall of the Roman Empire.
Yep, and he is building on Petrarch has this idea that you had the classical times and then you have the Dark Ages now because we've fallen off from the Golden Ages. But Bruni is the one who says, no, there's three periods going on. You have the classical, you have the stuff in the middle, and you have us, which are rediscovering and rebirthing the classical.
We're good. We are back. We're retro. We're retro classics.
So he has a giant discussion of the something called the history of the Florentine people. It's a 12-volume history. It's absolute.
You didn't read all of this, did you?
Oh God, no. Partially because my sad adventure this time is that nothing is available digitally unless you're willing to go to the pirate site calling itself a library known as the Internet Archive. Now, if you're not paying for the materials, you are a pirate site, whether you call yourself a library or not. So I have problems with that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do anything with that.
We have standards over here at 1,000 years of people behaving badly. We wish to not be in that group as much as possible.
Yes.
So we say no to the pirate sites where we can get all this wonderful information that people haven't actually paid for. And so that's not fair. Oh, well. Anyway, so you didn't get to read Bruni, which you would have done if you had found him.
I did. Yes, I would have. I did find a synopsis of what Bruni has to say, but it's not very long. So here it is. Most of the events described in Bruni's history aren't really momentous enough that they would still be widely remembered today or be considered as having a big influence on later periods. The blogger is talking about how for the whole of volume 3, he hadn't heard of any of it except for the Sicilian Vespers. And he says that Bruni does not use the term Vespers to refer to the uprising, nor does he imply that they started at that time of day. So that kind of implies that those things have, trickled in later, or that he didn't think they were important. But he does describe a curious sequence of events that directly precipitated the uprising, namely, and here is now, I am quoting the blogger who is quoting Bruni, the Palmeritans, apparently is what you do if you're from Palermo, were holding a festival outside the city when the French came up to check them for weapons, and on that pretext began fondling the breasts of the women. So Bruni is one of the sources for the stuff you were talking about. So that's cool. Mm-hmm. So Bruni, that was fun. And then I went down this other rabbit hole because they kept citing a book called The Sicilian Vespers by a 20th century historian named Stephen Runciman.
Yeah, this is the main study. Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, Stephen, first of all, you can't get a hold of the book because it's from 1958. You can either order it used and wait 3 weeks for it. So that was a bad thing. It's not available digitally. And if you can do, it's been reissued from its publisher, but it's a print on demand. So that also takes 3 weeks. However, it was reissued in a lot of volumes, and I went and I read book reviews of it from the time that it came out, and generally it was reviewed really well, so it was very frustrating to not be able to get a hold of that book. So I have absolutely no idea where, what sources Runciman was using.
Right.
But because Runciman talks about things that Bruni does not.
Yep.
Right. He's got a lot more detail about it, but I have absolutely no idea where it came from. However, I did learn a lot about Stephen Runciman, which was really interesting because he was a hoot and a half. He was born in 1903 and he died in the year 2000. So he lived to be 97. So first of all, that's really awesome. And he is primarily known for a 3-volume history of the Crusades, where he is the first Western historian to take the point of view that they were a bad idea.
Oh, so blessings on him because they were a horrible idea. Oh, yay. So he's the one who starts off that train of thought.
Yes.
Yay. So he's one of our heroes.
And it's super difficult to tell the assessment of his work is mixed, mm-hmm. because he doesn't spend most of his life. He spends about 10 years because he's actually Sir James Cochrane Stevenson Runciman. He is noble, right? He's the second son of a Viscount.
Uh-huh.
And so after his grandfather dies, he leaves his academic position and goes off and becomes he's independently wealthy. He goes off and travels the world and becomes an independent historian. So sometimes the people not liking his work kind of sound like they're just being snobs. It's so difficult. The assessment of his work is really mixed. Some people are saying, you know, it's really great. And some people are like, you know, this was just basically an amateur.
Right. But so, yeah, it's so frustrating, the position of independent scholars in general. So at that time also, because he had been an academician, is what you're saying.
Yeah, he spent 10 years working at Trinity College in Cambridge.
Okay, so he's not an amateur. You don't like all of a sudden become an amateur historian because you have left academia. Hello. So here we are.
Some of the pushback is probably just, you know, younger scholars needing to make their work mark. Some of the pushback is really like this scandalous, you know, he doesn't like the Crusades. What the hell? That would have been a big deal in England in the 1950s to be saying that, you know, he calls the Crusades the last barbarian invasion.
Yes, I love that. Absolutely. Absolutely.
He was also gay, which doesn't help in terms of people assessing him, you know, properly. But here is my very all-time favorite story that I found out about him. This is a hoot. Do you remember back to when we, in the Hugh Dispenser episode, there were the people from Cambridge who hired the sorcerer and they were going to kill?
Yes. There wasn't Cambridge. It was Nottingham.
Coventry. He was, Coventry, yes, John Coventry. John of Nottingham. Oh, yes.
John of Nottingham, and it was Coventry.
He was in Coventry. Okay. Stephen Runciman, when he was at Eton with Eric Blair, who would grow up and be George Orwell.
Right.
The two of them there was another boy who was mean to them and they hated. So they were both interested in the occult. They made, and this I swear to you is real, it's in a George Orwell biography. They made a little wax figure of the kid they didn't like and they broke its leg. And they were appalled that 2 weeks later he broke his leg, and then 6 months later he died of leukemia.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's very sad.
I know, but what happened was that word got around among the other kids.
My God. Yeah, as it would.
They kind of gave these two a wide berth.
Yeah.
For the whole rest of their time at Eton.
So this is twice now we have heard of death occurring after people have little wax figures and do things to them.
George Orwell gets scared shitless of the occult.
I guess, yeah, I totally get that.
And he swears off and has nothing to do with it for the rest of his life, but Runciman's like,
there's something here.
And he stays interested. He stays interested in it for the rest of his life.
Does he do any more things with wax figures that we know of, or just a study?
He has his very own biography, which again, alas, is not available digitally, or I totally would have read it.
Because he is a hero of true crime and evil. Yes.
Hold on, I will tell you the name of the biography because it's delightful. It is called Outlandish Night, with a K. The Byzantine Life of Stephen Runciman.
So we should all go find this.
And this is a new biography. This came out in 2016, which appalls me that it's not available as an ebook. What the hell? Make my life easier here, people.
No. There's nothing in here about easy. Well, this is lovely. Thank you. Because I knew Runciman was the main scholar for the Sicilian Vespers, but I did not know the rest of the stuff about him.
And he was a humongous distraction. So I learned a lot about Stephen Runciman and nothing whatsoever about the Sicilian Vespers.
I thought for sure, since there's a couple plays and operas, I thought for sure we were going to get the dramatic side of the Sicilian Vespers.
Yeah, sorry. I got the dramatic side of Stephen Runciman.
Well, if you're interested in hearing the Sicilian Vespers operas, there's stuff on YouTube. So Maria Callas was in it. Yeah, because Verdi does an opera called The Sicilian Vespers.
That is just really, really fascinating. I'm always astonished to discover enormous, humongous things that I have never heard of.
Well, and I do opera. I go to opera a lot, and I've never gotten to see this. But, you know, usually, well, not this year, things got canceled, but I go to the Santa Fe Opera, and they always have a world premiere, or at least an American premiere, so I get to see new things. But there's always a couple of war horses, you know, like how many times have I seen Madame Butterfly? Lots. Tosca? Lots. You know, I guess that kind of thing. But I've never seen the Sicilian Vespers. It's not widely performed, even though it's Verdi.
I can understand, though, why the Mafia would want to claim it as an origin story.
Yes, because by the time the Mafia comes along, it's Italy. Okay, fine. You know, so, and then here's our story, our origin story, where we fought against the French. Because the idea was that the Mafia was providing the, like, protection and things that the government couldn't do. Any rate, so, yeah, you can see why it would make a very good origin story.
I really would have liked to have seen Runciman's book, because I really would have liked to know, what sources do we have that's closer than 1414? Because that's a big, long time period for stuff to be developing.
The earliest narratives I'm reading from, I have gone to Wikipedia to answer this question. The earliest narrative source of the Vespers is the Sicilian language, written perhaps as early as 1287. And it credits John of Procida with organizing the overthrow of the French and portrays them in a positive light. And then there's a couple of Guelph histories later, Tuscan, from Tuscany, which look like they might be relying on the lost source of the one I just mentioned. And they stress John's involvement, John of Procida. Yeah, there's stuff about the organization. It does show up earlier. And there's a couple of Florentine chronicles, but these are these later ones. Yeah, even the early stuff we have, it all contradicts each other as to exactly how things started and to when the organization period took over.
That's something we're kind of running into a lot. We had that, particularly when it's something that's really fraught, we had that with Robert the Bruce and...
Yeah, exactly what happened to John Comyn and when Robert the Bruce...
Who started it? Whose fault was it? How did this happen?
Totally depends on who the chronicler is and what their allegiances are. Yeah, so that's our discussion of the Sicilian Vespers and the massacre of the French who happened to be on the island. Yeah, we don't know exactly what happened, but we know that the French were behaving badly, and then we know that the Sicilians had a revolt, and exactly what started that and how it got organized, we don't know. But it was a very important revolt, and it actually ended in Sicily having a small amount of freedom. They weren't allowed to create a free state, but they were able to get some help from Aragon, and they ended up with a ruler that they wanted for a while. And it was agreed that that they would have some freedoms when Philip took over. So that was that. But it's not the mafia.
I didn't know that was a thing, but
no, it's a thing, and it's not the mafia. So just stop that. Everybody stop that. No.
And that reminds me of the Templars episode where everything is trying to connect back up to the Templars.
That's right. Everything is from the Templars. No, this is the Sicilian Vespers were a successful rebellion, but they aren't the start of a whole long series of other rebellions. They're Sicily. They're Sicily.
So the rebellion isn't the crime. It's the inveterate slaughtering of everybody.
Yeah. So let's be clear about that. If indeed one or more of the Sicilian women were being manhandled and or raped, that was a crime. That was absolutely a crime. But we don't really know that. We do know that there were a whole bunch of dead French men, women, and children, not just the people who were governing this, like just the people who were living there. And so that was the crime. It was the slaughter, the massacre of the French citizens of Sicily. Were there, yeah, you know, I mean, does it make sense that it happened? Yeah, but it was bad. So that's our discussion of the Sicilian Vespers. And, you know, when we did the ghost, we forgot to say what we were doing next.
Oh.
Or I forgot to say what we were doing next because I think it's my job. So next time we meet up with you, we will be discussing the People's Crusades, the French and German People's Crusades. The Crusades are not the crime. What the people did in France and Germany, that's the crime. So We'll be back to the Crusades. Yeah, so that'll be nice. Where's my, here it is. I don't know. This is the most discombobulated I think I felt in a long time. And I really think it's the time. I mean, I think it's because it's just nuts around here. By around here, I mean the United States. This has been True Crime Medieval, where the crimes are just like they are today, but with less technology. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, iHeart Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere you're listening to podcasts, we seem to be there. Please leave a review, because we'd really appreciate that. We enjoy those so much. And you can reach us at truecrimemedieval.com. True Crime Medieval is all one word. And you can find there the show notes, which are written by Michelle, the transcripts, which are done for us by Laurie Dietrich. And you can also reach us all through the webpage. And you can leave comments. We'd love to hear from you. And if you have medieval crimes that you'd like for us to discuss, please let us know and we'll take it under consideration. One of my connections has asked us to for an episode that discusses the armor that Henry IV, I think, had made for his cat. And I'm not sure what the crime is, so I don't know if we're going to be able to get that in. But the armor is really quite fetching, and so it would make a great picture.
I wonder if there probably is a crime in there somewhere.
There's probably a crime, and if there's a crime, we'll talk about the armor made for the king's cat. So that's all for us. Bye.